You drop an apple, gravity pulls it down, up is up, down is down. It's predictable,
Right.
really.
There's a lot of comfort in that.
Exactly. We like reality to be a known quantity. But what happens when you step into a world where reality is just, well, completely arbitrary, where the laws of physics are replaced by these bizarre, hackable rules?
Can completely upends everything you know.
It really does. And if you are a learner tuning in today, you probably value understanding how complex systems work from the inside out. You know the value of questioning a system from the outside. So today's deep dive takes us right into the heart of a transcribed chronicle. It's this fascinating fantasy log detailing the collision between mortal minds and a magical realm called Mirari.
Yeah, and we are following two separated groups of adventurers who are navigating this dying magical land. I mean, this is a place currently suffering from a severe drought, intense political deception, and this set of incredibly rigid magical rules that basically govern every single interaction.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. And our goal today is to extract the core mechanics of this world. We're not just, summarizing a story here. We are decoding a complex, failing system.
Right, we want to figure out things like how does communication actually work when your messengers are literal birds? How do physical curses operate almost exactly like malicious computer code? And most importantly, how does an outsider's perspective, a mortal perspective, become the ultimate weapon against ancient magic?
That's the big question.
Okay, let's unpack this and transition right into our first scene, high up in the ruined, freezing tower of Cair Benguac.
Oh, it is such a brilliantly atmospheric starting point. It immediately introduces us to the friction of this world. We've got two of our adventurers,
Oh,
a
yeah.
mortal girl named Agatha, also known as Redmayne, and her fairy companion, Hannah.
Right.
And they're waking up in this freezing stone hall. The fire has died. The walls are just coated with a thick layer of dew. And there is this relentless, unnerving tap, tap, tapping at the heavy wooden door.
Which is terrifying because they are completely on edge. They're in a land filled with trolls and lethal danger, so Agatha naturally just grabs her sword, expecting a monster.
Yep, she's ready for a fight.
But the visitor is a crow, specifically a messenger crow from House October named Ryland. And this interaction is so delightful because it perfectly illustrates that mechanical culture clash happening in Mirari. Agatha opens the window, lets the freezing bird in, and the crow just starts shouting random words back at them.
It's so funny.
The crow says, "Guard." Agatha says, "Guard against what?" And the crow just replies, "What?"
It is entirely maddening for Agatha. And Hannah, who is native to this magical world, has to step in and explain the hidden mechanic at play. She reminds Agatha that crows in Mirari naturally like to repeat your words back to you. If you want a straight answer from a messenger crow, you have to ask them something directly, exactly twice.
I immediately thought of a glitchy smart home
Oh,
speaker.
absolutely.
You know, you're standing in your kitchen shouting at the little cylinder on your counter, but because you didn't use the exact right prompt, it just cheerfully parrots your words back or tells you it doesn't understand.
Yeah, you have to speak its language.
You literally have to learn the specific syntax of the machine to get utility out of it. Magic here is just prompt engineering, and that clash of worlds of baseline technologies is everywhere in this scene. Like when they decide to write a reply to the crow's message, Hannah brings out a battered quill, an ink pot, and a little pot of sand, and Agatha is completely baffled by the sand.
Right. Hannah has to explain this archaic method of sprinkling sand over wet ink to blot it, to keep the parchment from smearing.
Which is so tedious.
Exactly. And Agatha casually mentions that where she comes from, ink dries faster because they use fountain pens. She even brings up an opticon, a camera, that they brought from the mortal world.
Oh man, Hannah's reaction to that.
That simple mention absolutely blows Hannah's mind. To a native of Mirari, a camera is an item of myth. It really highlights how a world governed by magic often suffers from technological stagnation.
Because if magic solves your basic problems, you never invent the fountain pen.
What's fascinating here is that the crow's repetitive behavior isn't just a quirky biological trait of Mirari birds. Hannah explicitly states that this is one of the rules of Mirari,
With a capital R.
with a capital R. When she says rules, she doesn't mean a legal guideline or some polite societal suggestion. She means the physical, immutable laws governing their reality. To break them is unthinkable to a native of this world.
Yeah, Agatha asks if these are agreed upon laws or physical ones, and Hannah can barely even comprehend the distinction.
The universe is simply built that way to her.
But think about the implications of that for a second. While Agatha and Hannah are dealing with the literal frustrating rules of a stubborn bird in a freezing tower, across the world in a desert city called Kerry-CD, their friend Thomas is grappling with the profound philosophical weight of these very same rules.
The narrative shifts so seamlessly to Thomas, known as the Lord Explorer, and his companion, a fairy named Rachel. They are up on a cold, tiled rooftop in the middle of the night, just looking out over the stars and the sprawling, dark bazaar of the city below them.
Neither of them can sleep, right?
Right, because of the sheer danger ahead. They get into this deep conversation about the fundamental differences between the mortal world and Mirari.
And Rachel had previously visited a mortal town called Anikton, and she admits she actually misses it. She expected a world without magic to be, like, intensely boring, surrounded by what she calls dumb animals and simple things.
But it wasn't.
No. Instead, she found an unexpected peace. She talks about how the mortal people were trusting and kind. Nobody was constantly plotting or trying to find a magical advantage to leverage against her.
It is a stark contrast to the courtly life in Mirari.
Oh, yeah.
Which is entirely defined by political maneuvering, suspicion, and rigid social hierarchies. She found the absence of magic actually created a vacuum that allowed for genuine, uncomplicated human connection.
But wait, I have to ask you, and listener too, is the mortal world actually that peaceful? I mean, if you look at human history, it isn't exactly a peaceful stroll in the park. Is it possible Rachel just thinks it's peaceful because she, as a magical being, is completely free from the intense political baggage of her own world when she visits ours? Like, she's a tourist.
Aye.
She's not enmeshed in the mortal economy or our power struggles.
That is a highly astute observation.
Yeah.
She was experiencing the hospitality reserved for a guest, completely detached from the systemic pressures of mortal life.
Exactly.
However, her idealized outsider view of the mortal world triggers something absolutely vital in Thomas. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Thomas has this massive, paradigm-shifting revelation right there on the roof.
Oh, this part's huge.
For 14 Mirari years, which is their measure of time, Thomas has carried immense guilt. He genuinely believed he had failed his world by abandoning it for the mortal realm.
He thought he was a deserter.
He did. But listening to Rachel talk about how the rules of Mirari are eternal and unchanging to its natives, he suddenly realizes his absence wasn't a failure at all. It was a strategic necessity.
Wait, explain that.
Well, if you are born inside a system where the rules are absolute, you literally cannot conceive of changing them. You are blind to the architecture of your own prison.
So Thomas realizes that to save Mirari, he had to leave. He had to assimilate into the mortal world so he could step outside the Mirari system entirely.
Yes, only an outsider, someone not bound by the internal logic of the game, has the perspective required to rewrite the rules.
That is so profound. If you're listening to this and feeling stuck in your own career or a creative project, think about how often we try to solve a problem using the exact same framework that created it. Thomas proves you need that external mortal perspective to break the cycle.
And breaking that cycle is an existential imperative right now. Their enemy, an ancient evil known as the Destroyer or Jack, has weaponized Mirari's stagnant nature against its own people. He exploits their inability to adapt.
Which brings us to the actual mechanics of how this enemy operates. I mean, how do you weaponize a rigid system?
You do it through curses.
Yes. The next morning, Thomas and Rachel are analyzing a book recovered from a witch's lair to figure out how to break a massive curse at a place called Gallen Anne, where the water has completely dried up.
They are studying the literal anatomy of a curse. Rachel translates from the text that curses in this world aren't just, you know, spoken spells that float ethereally in the air.
Right. They aren't just words.
They are anchored to physical, symbolic objects hidden strategically near the target.
The details provided here explain the how behind the magic beautifully. Rachel says that to curse a farmer's field, a witch wouldn't just wave a wand and chant. She would hide a bag of dry soil mixed with salt, along with a seed that has had its heart eaten out by a worm right near the center of the farm. Through sympathetic magic, the physical decay of the object forces a metaphysical decay on the land. So Thomas deduces that to break a curse that dried up a water source, they need to find an object symbolizing the absolute absence of water. Like a dry gourd filled with sand, a mirror designed to focus heat and evaporate moisture, or maybe even a skeleton.
The physical object dictates the metaphysical reality. The magic is completely tethered to the material world.
I love this concept because it operates exactly like a computer virus localized on a hidden USB flash drive.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, you can't just run an ethereal antivirus scan or chant a counterspell to delete the software. You literally have to go rummaging through the physical server room, find the malicious hardware plugged into the wall, and smash it with a hammer.
Taking that analogy further, it means the magic is tangible, and therefore it is vulnerable if you have the technical knowledge to locate the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
But just as Thomas and Rachel are formulating a plan to find this localized physical anchor, the broader geopolitical reality crashes down on them.
It really does. Rylan the Crow finally catches up to them in the marketplace.
And he delivers a letter from Agatha and Alice that completely shatters their worldview.
Through this cryptic letter, Thomas pieces together a terrifying truth. The Destroyer, this ancient world-ending threat they believed was gathering dark forces out in the dangerous western wastelands, isn't out there at all.
No, he's much closer.
He is back at the court, flawlessly impersonating one of their most trusted leaders, Lord April.
This realization hits the group like a physical blow, and the impact is most severe on Sir Lefalon, a young earnest knight traveling with them.
Poor Lefalon.
Lefalon is from House April. He had been secretly sending reports to Lord April this entire time, fully believing he was serving the best interests of his realm.
Oh, man.
Discovering that he has been taking orders from and providing intelligence to, the ultimate enemy completely breaks him. He drops to his knees in the dust, just horrified by his unwitting treason.
This raises an important question. Wait, no, you usually say that.
I do. This raises an important question. How does an ancient evil actually conquer a sprawling magical land? We always picture massive armies, dragons, and fiery skies, but the Destroyer's greatest weapon is paranoia.
Paranoia.
Look closely at Rachel's reaction. The moment she finds out Lefalon is from House April and kept his communications a secret, her expression freezes into an unreadable mask. She instantly draws away from him, physically and emotionally.
She turns to ice. Lefalon is practically screaming his innocence, swearing he would rather burn in hell than willingly serve the Destroyer, but the damage is already done. The seed of doubt is planted.
The enemy's true power isn't just casting illusions. It is meticulously making allies doubt one another. By infiltrating the court so perfectly that even the master thaumaturges didn't notice, the Destroyer erodes the very foundation of societal trust.
Right.
If you can't trust your government leaders and you can't trust the knight guarding your back, the realm falls from the inside out without a single spell being cast in battle.
It is psychological warfare executed flawlessly. Thomas has to step in, desperately trying to mediate, reminding them that they are friends and must stand together.
It's a tense moment.
Very tense. But that high-level geopolitical deception Thomas is fighting at the top of the hierarchy filters all the way down to the streets. While Thomas is dealing with the erosion of trust, our other group, Agatha and Hannah, are about to crash headfirst into the brutal economic reality of the very curse Thomas is trying to break.
We shift back to the dusty, desperate gates of Karasidi, where Agatha and Hannah have just arrived. The atmosphere is suffocatingly oppressive.
Oppressive almost feels like an understatement. The local merchants are screaming at each other, aggressively trying to sell water for exorbitant prices. One merchant is shouting, "Only one silver a bag!"
Which is insane.
Hannah points out that one silver is a price you would normally pay for a bottle of fine wine, not a basic pouch of drinking water.
The desperation just permeates the crowd. A young, dust-covered beggar girl approaches Agatha and Hannah, pleading for just a drop of water. Hannah, being naturally generous, takes out her water skin, which to the starving locals looks like she is flaunting a massive fortune, and gives the child a cup to drink.
This single act of unregulated kindness immediately draws the attention of the local enforcers. A creepy man in thick black robes approaches them. He has this dry, hoarse voice. He calls Hannah rich in water, sarcastically compliments her generosity, and then simply reaches out and touches her cheek.
And the physical consequence is immediate and devastating.
Yeah.
Within moments of the man in the black robe walking away, Hannah becomes dizzy, violently shaky, and too weak to even mount her horse properly. She has been hit with a localized curse simply for disrupting the local economy of suffering.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If you're listening to this and wondering why the authorities don't just arrest these guys, you have to understand their function. These black robes aren't just dark wizards doing evil magic for the aesthetic thrill of it.
No, not at all.
They are operating exactly like a mafia, or more accurately, a ruthless utility cartel. They are enforcing a brutal monopoly on the town's water supply, using magical violence as their enforcement arm.
It is pure economic warfare enforced by arcane law. We get the full, tragic lore behind this mechanism from a veiled beggar named Pelis.
Agatha is actually guided to Pelis by her incredibly perceptive cross-eyed cat, Bragwaine, and her night steed horse, Ahern, right?
Yes. The animals sense the latent danger in the streets and find the one safe harbor in the entire city.
Once Agatha gets the severely weakened Hannah to safety at this old woman's house, she sits down with Pelis to uncover the mechanics of this cartel. The history he shares is a masterclass in how monopolies are born from desperation.
Pelis explains that this entire geographic area used to be a dead, uninhabitable desert called Zin. But generations ago, a refugee mage struck a rock twice at a place called Mariba.
Okay.
Water violently gushed out, terraforming the desert into a lush green forest. But there was a catch. The mage was banished because he struck the rock in anger rather than in faith.
It's a classic mythic structure. The vital miracle comes permanently attached to a moral failing.
Over the generations, the forest flourished, settlers arrived, and the true history faded into local myth. The area was renamed Annon. But recently, the water mysteriously dried up. The forest rapidly turned back to sand. As the populace grew desperate and faced starvation, the Guild of the Black Robes arrived with a solution.
But the Black Robes didn't just offer water. They offered a Faustian bargain. They claimed they could fix the drought if the town allowed them to use an ancient artifact called the Cauldron.
And the town was desperate, so they agreed.
Exactly. The desperate town agreed. The Black Robes used their alchemy to artificially produce water, and then they did exactly what unchecked monopolies always do. They started relentlessly raising the prices.
Shocker.
Right. They used curses to drive out or kill any competing water merchants. Now they act like a corrupt central bank that also possesses a private military. They hold the entire city hostage. If you speak against them or dare to give water away for free like Hannah did, you get cursed.
It loops perfectly back to Thomas's realization on the roof about the rules. The people of Kara City are trapped in an economic system they cannot escape. They accept the extortion because the Black Robes have convinced them that this rigid, brutal system is their only option for survival. They literally cannot imagine an alternative reality.
The narrative accelerates rapidly from here. Rylan the Crow suddenly shows up at Pella's window, completely out of breath. He warns Agatha that three of these Black Robes are currently riding fast on the North Road.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they are heading straight for Gallen Anne to intercept and eliminate Thomas, who is actively trying to break their localized water curse.
The monopoly is deploying its enforcers to defend its capital.
Agatha immediately pivots into action. She tells Pella she needs to ride her horse, Ahern, to catch the Black Robes and save Thomas. But before she rides out, there is a crucial philosophical exchange that perfectly defines the power of the mortal perspective in Mirari.
Agatha pulls out this glowing red potion she brought with her from the mortal world. She asks Pelles to explicitly tell her what it does, hoping it will give her a tactical advantage in the coming fight.
Right, she wants instructions.
But Pelles flatly refuses to answer her. He states that he is actually doing her a massive favor by withholding the information. He challenges her to consider what she has already learned about how her mortal world interacts with the physics of Mirari.
Agatha puzzles through the mechanics of it. She realizes that in Mirari, mortal imagination, which isn't bound by the local rules, can literally become reality. So if Pelles gives her the official answer of what the potion does, it permanently locks the potion into a specific rigid rule.
Precisely the point. If he says it heals cuts, then the magic is compiled. It only heals cuts.
Yeah.
But by leaving its function entirely undefined, Agatha's own belief can shape its power dynamically when she needs it most. In a world choked by rigid rules, oppressive economic monopolies, and ancient curses, an undefined mortal imagination is the ultimate wild card. She has the power to dictate reality simply because she doesn't know she isn't supposed to.
It is a brilliant subversion of how magic systems are usually written. I mean, so what does this all mean for us? Let's bring this all back together. Today, we've seen that magic in Mirari isn't some mystical, unknowable force. It is a set of hackable rules, as rigid as prompt engineering a crow to get an answer or finding a cursed bag of salt like a hidden USB drive.
And we've also explored the mechanics of control. Villains maintain dominance not just through armies, but by monopolizing vital resources like water and sowing paranoia to keep their enemies internally divided and unable to collaborate.
And most importantly, we learned the value of the outsider perspective. Sometimes you are simply too close to a broken system to see the cracks. You have to leave it entirely, like Thomas did, to realize that the rules governing your life aren't actually unbreakable laws of physics.
It requires stepping back to see the architecture of the cage.
Exactly. But I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. If Murari's magic operates so much like a rigidly coded computer system, complete with malware curses and localized hardware, and it is so deeply vulnerable to mortal hackers who can rewrite the rules with their imagination, it makes you wonder who or what wrote the original code for that world in the first place. And looking at our own universe, if we operate on the strict, unbreakable laws of physics, what would a mortal perspective look like to a being from a higher dimension looking down at our code? Could they just rewrite our gravity because they don't know they aren't supposed to?
That's a wild thought.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We invite you to bring your next stack of sources so we can decode even more hidden systems together. Until then, keep questioning the rules.